when Napoleon lay at Boulogne for a year with his flat-bottomed boats and his grand army, he was told by someone, there are bitter weeds in England. There are certainly a great many more of them since the British expeditionary force returned. Sir, I have myself full confidence that if all do their duty, if nothing is neglected, and if the best arrangements are made, as they are being made, we shall prove ourselves once more able to defend our island home, to ride out the storm of war, and to outlive the menace of tyranny, if necessary for years, if necessary alone. At any rate, that is what we are going to try to do. That is the resolve of His Majesty's government, every man of them. That is the will of Parliament and the nation, the British Empire and the French Republic, linked together in their cause and in their need, will defend to the death their native soil, aiding each other like good comrades to the utmost of their strength. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
Andor Roll. I'm your reluctant host, BJ, and here we are. We've made it to album number 5 in the Iron Maiden catalog, and joining me to talk about that record, Power Slave, I'm pleased to once again be joined by the co-hosts of a great podcast called Decibel Geek, Chris Sinzak and Aaron Camiro. Hey, guys.
Hola.
What's up, man?
How's it going?
It's great to be back. It's great to be back.
Yes, we're...
Great to have you back.
We're honored to have to come on and to talk about such an awesome record. You saved us for the best record of the catalog.
Yes.
That might be debatable.
You can't
disco. Yeah, I have to tell you guys, while I have you on, that your Perry Richardson interview a couple months back was so great. I just loved it. Those stories, it just kept getting better and better as he went.
Yeah.
It's got to be one of the most entertaining interviews I've ever heard, but it, that, you know... It, was in my wheelhouse, but that was so great.
It really exceeded our expectations. I know that's a fact.
Oh yeah.
he was a true character, and man, he was the gift that kept on giving through about a 2-hour interview there.
Oh man, he was super cool, man. So much fun to be around, and just a nice guy. And his wife was here, and she was super cool, and it was a good time, man. Yeah, the stories, they were just, I kept looking over at Chris, going like, giving him the holy shit look, you know.
I even before I released the episode, you know, those of us that interview people, we'll, you know, pull certain quotes from the interview and send them to the news sites and hope to get it picked up. And I'm putting all these quotes together, and I kept shaking my head, and I had to text Perry a couple of times going, are you sure this story about this is really true, Perry? Because I'm about to put it out there. And he's like, yep, it's true. I was like, okay.
Yeah, because it was so far
out. I felt like
he
was pulling our leg a couple of times. I was like, are you being serious? And he's like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Like the Alice in Chains story. I couldn't tell if he was messing with us or not.
I totally thought he was messing
with us. Yeah, it was cool.
The Nugent story was completely insane, and the story about the guy getting eaten by a tiger.
Oh yeah,
it was unbelievable. So
yeah, you never know what's gonna happen at a firehouse show.
Yeah. But so you guys want to tell your Iron Maiden stories? Like, how did you get into the band, or what do they mean to you, or where do they rank for you, anything like that?
I guess for me, it always starts where it always starts for me. My Uncle Bruce, my awesome Uncle Bruce. You know, selling off his LP collection because he's investing in cassette tapes because it's the wave of the future, boy. Look, you know? And so then for $1 a piece, because that was the agreement, I think he was just going to give them to me. He gave me all his Kiss albums, and then he was going to give me the rest, I think. But my parents said, no, sell them to him for $1 a piece so that we can, you know, make them work around the house and try to earn some money. So I would do whatever I could to earn my $5 allowance for the week, which it wasn't really allowance. It was more like my paycheck every week. And I would take my $5 and I'd run over to my Uncle Bruce's house and I'd buy up as many LPs as I could get, you know, and have a little money left over for comic books and candy or whatever. But, you know, because I was pretty young. And, yeah, I finally got up to, I got the Kiss and I got the Ozzy and I got the Sabbath. And then I was working my way on through stuff just trying to discover, because a lot of it was albums. I'm just looking through his massive album collection every time, just picking stuff out and looking at the Maiden covers. Was like, wow, you know, I got to get this. And Power Slave was the first one that I ever brought home, because I think I had like 4 of them when I bought them. And I brought them home, and Power Slave was the first one I put on for whatever reason. I think the artwork on the cover is just so amazing that it jumped out to me, and that's what I put on, and that's what hooked me in Maiden. So it's super fitting for me to be having this discussion with you guys today, because this is the album that got me in Maiden for sure.
Huh, interesting.
And is it your favorite album?
It is my favorite album. Yeah, over the years, I mean, even at that time, then listening to that, and I don't think it was just the initial, you know, reaction to it of this was the first one, so it's special to me, because I had 4 of those at the same time, and I think it was like Killers and Peace of Mind and probably, you know, the other ones, or other early ones that came around the same time, but. Over the years, even Power Slave has still stuck with me as my favorite. I think this Iron Maiden at their peak, at the height of their powers.
Somewhere in Time was the first Maiden album I had, and I got it on cassette because it was the wave of the future. One of my friends in school had it, and I dug it purely because of the cover art, you know, because you couldn't help but be impressed by it.
Right.
I mean, it looked like a sci-fi comic book cover art, and I was just like, what is that? That's cool. And I remember Iron Maiden. I remember Maiden from earlier than that, because the first exposure I had was the Number of the Beast video on MTV, because I was one of the earliest kids on my block to have MTV. And that video would come on late night.
Scare the hell out of you, man.
I remember that video and then Run to the Hills. I remember those two videos. Those were the first exposure I had to them. And then I grew up in the South, in the rural South, so Maiden had the whole, you know, satanic type thing attached to them at that time, and parents were scared of them, and I remember they came into Atlanta, I think, to play the Omni, and it was a big news stories, and like churches were protesting their concert, and so of course, which made it very cool to a little kid, you know, at the time. But the first album I got was Somewhere in Time. I got on cassette. My friend loaned it to me. But I, you know, as you'll hear through the show, I did not latch on to Maiden super big right away. I enjoyed some of the songs on Somewhere in Time, but at the time, I was getting into Poison and Rat and Motley Crue and all the hair bands were really what was, you know, diverting my attention rather than Maiden. I didn't get into heavier music until later on. So Power Slave really didn't come into my view until early 90s.
Yeah.
Once I started getting into heavier music, I got into thrash in the late 80s, basically when Injustice for All came out. I got into thrash music, and then I had friends that would connect the dots on that. And like, well, if you like thrash, you should listen to some Iron Maiden. It's not thrash by any means, but it's in the same family. So I got into Power Slave around that time. But I'm not the biggest garden variety diehard Iron Maiden fan. I'm a Fringe fan, and I'm not going to pretend that I'm not. I'm not going to pretend I'm a diehard. I'm being honest.
Well, your perception will be appreciated.
Well, but
unbiased.
It is unbiased, believe me. And but I, you know, since BJ invited us to come do this episode, you know, I was like, well, I really need to sink my teeth into Power Slave, which I'm familiar with all the songs, and I have been for years. You can't, you didn't go to a stoner party unless you heard this album, you know, a few times. And I appreciate it, but then listening to it in depth over the last week, I mean, it's, like I said, I never thought I'd say it was their best album, but until this week, but I do think it is when you compare it to all the others, because it's basically everything you would want from Iron Maiden in an album. And yeah, there's no filler. It's all killer. I don't think there's not a bad song on the album. No. It's only 8 songs, which I don't remember it being only 8 songs, but it was. But before this, I was really more partial to the Deano era stuff. Because I like the rawness of it. And digging into this in depth, and I'm really rambling, I do love this album.
I think Peace of Mind and Power Slave really go together as kind of sibling albums, if that's the way to say it.
Right.
But,
right.
Yeah. And this is the first time they don't have a lineup change.
Right.
Yeah. It was
so it's the same band. So in a lot of ways, they are sister albums.
Yeah.
And I always heard it, to me, it sounds like a combination of Number of the Beast and the one after, then, you know, and then it resulted in this, you know. There's almost a Rush influence on some of the songs I hear, because especially the way some of the songs are laid out, they have that, which we'll get into it when we do track by track, but, you know, just certain songs will go through a pathway where it's like, I could have easily heard Neil Peart, you know, writing some of those changes.
Yeah, so Power Slave came out September of 1984, and like we said, it's the same lineup, and Peace of Mind, it betters Peace of Mind as far as chart position, barely. Peace of Mind went to number 3 in the UK, and this album went to number 2, and Peace of Mind went to 14 in the US, and this album went to number 12, so...
Yeah.
Peace of Mind was really when they kind of hit in the US, and then this album just really maintained that momentum. And then, like, you're talking about your first exposure being Somewhere in Time. Well, that I remember as being, I first heard Peace of Mind just because, like, Aaron, my uncle, that's the one he had. But Power Slave had already come out, I think, by the time I got introduced to them. So Somewhere in Time was like the first new Maiden album coming out when I was aware of them. And I remember Wasted Years being huge on MTV, and it seemed like they were going to have bigger crossover success than they actually ended up having.
Yeah.
I think Maiden, you know, they never exploded. They just always maintained this level of popularity where their records were going platinum and they were very famous, but they, you know, Wasted Years, I guess, was probably as close as they came to having a hit single that kind of took them, that kind of crossed over, but they never really quite did cross over.
Well, if they had done more songs like Wasted Years, they would have, because that's clearly the most radio-friendly song they ever did, I think. And I love that song. That song is a big diamond on that record, because I like Somewhere in Time, but it's certainly not my favorite album by them, because I do think there are some weak points on that album.
See, and I think that's a good point, too, about, you know, taking their high popularity and just kind of plateauing and maintaining without becoming superstars. That also saves them from being looked at as a band that's a sellout,
that's
too.
True.
You know, they're at that perfect borderline between being, you know, mega popular worldwide and also not being sellouts at the same time. Yeah. It's a good place to be for Iron Maiden, and they've held that spot for a long time.
So, yeah, this would be the peak, probably just in terms of, like, legendary status. Power Slave probably was the peak for Iron Maiden. It probably really was. Yeah. And then a gradual descent began. You know, even though they really had that brush with success on Somewhere in Time, it just wasn't as good, and it didn't have, like, the staying power. And it's not as revered. Somewhere in Time definitely isn't as revered as Peace of Mind and as, you know, Number of the Beast, Peace of Mind, Power Slave. They just hold a different place, you know, as far as legendary status and respect and reverence, you know.
Well, and maybe the majority of the public was like me, and it was a little bit high-minded compared to what the majority of the public was into. Because, I mean, as much as I love Rad and Poison and Motley Crue, there was nothing complex about that stuff, but that seemed to be like what the mainstream audience was eating up. And that was what was topping the charts and was just, it, I mean, in the hair metal era, bowled everything else over at the time.
Right.
For sales. And so, you know, it was probably a little too complex for what, you know, to break through into that huge, you're going to play, of course, it's funny we say this now, but they're playing stadiums now, but at the time it was like they weren't going to get into that mega, mega star level because of, you've got a song like on this album that's almost 14 minutes long.
Right.
You know, the general public was not really looking for that, you know.
Well, then I think on top of that, too, if you factor in the fact that Iron Maiden is kind of a, like you say, a scary kind of band to a lot of people, you know.
Especially
the fact that
then.
They're a little bit smarter than what's, you know, the popular mainstream of rock and what's popular at the time in 84. But, you know, they're also scary, too. So you got kind of two things working against them, but keeping them from breaking through that upper echelon.
And I think for metal around that year was pretty crazy, because I mean, if you look at, and I wish I was buying metal albums at this time, because good lord, you've got, during that year you had Kill 'Em All, Defenders of the Faith, Last in Line, Love at First Sting, Fistful of Metal, Ride the Lightning, Slide It In, and Shout at the Devil, and this album.
Nice.
All released in the same year.
Viva 1984.
I mean, that's pretty amazing. So, you know, that limits your audience there, because people like familiarity, and they were not familiar to anything.
One thing, a great memory that I have, and BJ, you know, growing up in Wisconsin, I'm sure you can probably relate to this too, is being a young kid at like the county fair and playing the game where you threw the darts at the balloons and you could win little mirrors that had paintings on them. And it was always
those.
The Iron Maiden that you wanted because they were so cool looking.
Yep. Maiden certainly wins the award for the greatest artwork of that era.
Yeah, they do.
They could sell so many posters and shirts. And I mean, I'm sure Maiden sold more of that kind of stuff than any other band at that time, just because of Eddie, you know?
Oh, sure.
Most definitely. And again, too, like you said, with the people protesting their concerts and stuff, it was those covers are what made people afraid.
Oh,
you know?
Man, people freaked out.
Once they got past the covers and into the lyrics, it's like, oh boy, here's something to make a sign and stand out in front of an arena over.
I'll never forget the protest, the news stories on the protests, and people were up in arms about that band showing up and playing an arena.
But you look at the songs and the lyrics over the years, there ain't nothing satanic about this band.
Now it's more historical than lyrics about history more than anything else.
Well, I guess if we're going to do the track by track, saying that is a perfect way to lead us into the first song on the album, I would say.
Yeah, exactly. And this is, you know, first song, once again, it's about fighter pilots, same as the first song on Peace of Mind. But as much as I love Where Eagles Dare, I would have to say Ace is High is an even better song. I mean, this is just, you know, Ace is High was a film, a 1976 film about World War I fighter pilots. You know, Where Eagles Dare was also a film about World War II fighter pilots. But this song supposedly is about World War II. So I don't know where it factors in with the movie, or if he just took the name, or where the movie got the name. I mean, obviously, Aces High is a term from poker, but also I read that fighter pilots, after they had shot down their fifth plane, they were called an ace.
Yeah.
So Aces High becomes like a kind of a play on words. So as far as why, you know, what the inspiration is for the song, probably in part the title from the movie, but I suppose it's about the Battle of Britain in World War II, so... Not sure, but I mean, as far as Maiden goes, this is pretty much the ultimate song, wouldn't you say? With the harmony guitars and the riffs and the fast pace and the soaring chorus, it's just all here. This is as good as Maiden gets. I mean, this is Iron Maiden. This song just embodies everything, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's not 10 minutes plus. But no, right? You're right. It's everything you would look for in a classic Iron Maiden song. It's got, you know, it's got the gallop. It's got the, you know, Steve. Boy, this is going to really piss off Iron Maiden fans, but my bitch as a guitar player is the guitars are mixed so low and the bass is mixed so loud, which, you know, Steve Harris is calling the shots on this record because the bass is literally in your face throughout the whole record, especially on this song. If I had any criticism of it, I would raise the guitars up, but that's where it ends. I mean, because it's Bruce's vocals are completely on point. The lyrical content is awesome, you know. If I'm going to be a smartass, I'd say I always thought they were singing about Ace Frehley, but what do I know? But he was high a lot back in those days. But no, it's a perfect song, and you couldn't pick a better album opener. I can't believe we haven't played this as one of our album openers for the specials we do on album openers. And I mean, that's it, because it certainly qualifies.
Yeah, most definitely. And another thing about this song, I think that we kind of forget, because being citizens of the United States of America, this is a really, really patriotic song. I mean, especially when you factor in the video, and it's got the images of the World War II pilots and Nazi Germany taking over and coming in to invade England and all that, and the Churchill speech leading into it. Man, I always thought that was really cool on the video. We will never surrender. And then the song kicks in. And, you know, for people in the UK that listen to this, I got to imagine it kind of brings up really strong feelings of patriotism for their country, the way that some songs and images do for us here in the United States. I got to imagine it does the same for them there.
Mm-hmm.
And this song always links, in my brain, it links to, in 1982, two of my favorite bands back then. In 1983, Twisted Sister came out with a song called Live to Ride, Ride to Live.
Yeah.
And then Dokken, the same year, came out with a song called Live to Rock, Rock to Live. And then the next year, Maiden tell us, no, you gotta live to fly.
Yeah.
Fly to live. So,
God.
Yeah, I'm not sure, you know,
it's like heavy metal,
ride,
Mad
rock,
Libs.
Or fly, but more all three.
It's heavy metal Mad Lib. No, that's hilarious. It's a great song. It's, you know, what criticism can you have of it? It's they couldn't have, this may be the best album opener of their entire career.
It's pretty much perfection. Aces High was actually the second single. Song number two was the first single, I believe, right? And 2 Minutes to Midnight. Adrian Smith, I was reading Adrian Smith say that he wrote this song, but he let Bruce write the lyrics because Bruce was better at writing Maiden-type lyrics or lyrics that fit in with the Maiden aesthetic. I mean, you could hear in songs Adrian Smith writes, he just writes more straightforward rock and roll songs. Obviously, there's a huge gulf between Adrian Smith style songs and Steve Harris style songs usually.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
Bruce Dickinson seems to be able to do it all, you know. Like, there's a song on here later that Bruce Dickinson wrote by himself that sounds exactly like a Steve Harris song, so.
Yep.
But, yeah, 2 Minutes to Midnight, it's kind of more of a basic hard rock or metal song, you know? I mean, it's kind of closer to Rock You Like a Hurricane than Ace is High.
Right.
To me, and I definitely liked it when I was a kid, but at this point I think I'm pretty burned out on it. Just, you know, it's a great song, but I don't really want to hear it, just like I don't want to hear Rock You Like a Hurricane. But the thing I would say about 2 Minutes to Midnight is the lyrics are really great. I love the lyrics to this song. Very cool.
Very of its time. I mean, yeah. The Cold War was in full swing, and everyone was scared to death of what Reagan was going to do to Russia and vice versa. And the craziest thing is the clock was at 3 minutes at the time, and it's gone, and it went up to as high as 17 minutes in the 90s. I went ahead and looked this up.
Yeah.
And as of now, it's back to 3 minutes again.
Dang.
So, the doomsday clock, right?
Yeah, doomsday clock that it's written about. And
that's like the prediction of how close we are to nuclear death, right?
Global catastrophe, yeah, from nuclear war or
whatever it may
climate change and whatnot. So, yeah, we're not doing real well.
The clock is a metaphor for how close we are from destroying the planet. It is a summary view of leading experts deeply engaged in the existential challenges of our time.
A year ago, the clock was moved forward to 3 minutes to midnight. At that time, the bulletin stated, "The clock ticks now at just 3 minutes to midnight because international leaders are failing to perform their most important duty, ensuring and preserving the health and vitality of human civilization." The decision not to move the hands of the doomsday clock in 2016 is not good news, but an expression of grave concern that the situation remains largely the same.
Nuclear modernization programs continue. China, Pakistan, India, and North Korea are all increasing their nuclear arsenals, making more weapons, albeit at different rates. And the U.S. and Russia, as Lawrence mentioned, are modernizing their arsenals. It is very hard to reduce your reliance on nuclear weapons when you expect to spend more than $350 billion modernizing them.
I still have hopes that the American political process, as Winston Churchill once said, having tried everything else, usually ends up doing the right thing. But it will be a long and somewhat, put it this way, disillusioning year as we elect a new president.
I could see why you would be burned out on it, because you've probably heard this is one that, like, I would love to hear this on the radio as much as Rock You Like a Hurricane, but I never hear this on the radio.
Oh yeah, true.
I mean,
but I was gonna say, if a radio station, be it, you know, terrestrial or be it satellite, if they're playing a Iron Maiden song, that's the one, isn't it?
I don't think
Number
they play
of the
any.
Beast, Number of the Beast gets played once in a while on radio here, but for the most part, they never get played on the radio.
Yeah.
Which is bizarre. If a band that's that legendary never gets radio play, it's just strange.
It is strange. That's at least the state of radio right there.
You know,
what's
like
wrong with you?
People complain about Kiss not getting radio play, but you hear Rock and Roll All Night, Lick It Up, and I Was Made for Loving You here and there. But like, you'll at least hear them regularly. You never hear Iron Maiden on the radio.
Yeah, that's true.
It's odd. But no, I think it's a cool song, but... And you know,
video, man,
and the video
is freaking insane. I watched it earlier because it's been so long since I've seen it, and it's really hard to follow. You know, it's like if you're watching the video, it almost takes you away from the song because the video is so screwed up, crazy, and makes no sense.
But yeah, some of the lyrics to this song are so cool. Like the line, "Blackened pride still burns inside this shell of bloody treason," and I love where he says, cut the meat and lick the gravy. The way Bruce delivers some of these lines,
he's real
great.
He's so expressive on this record. Like, you hear him completely take the form of characters while he sings on this album.
To kill the unborn.
And I love the lyrics on the next song.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the next song, Last Words Big Or, is a real problem for me because
really
I don't usually care for instrumentals unless they're really great, like Transylvania is really great on the first Maiden album, or like Narita by Riot, but this is kind of blah. I don't hear anything that special about it. I just think putting it third on the record is crazy. I mean, this should be at the end of the side if it's on here at all. Yeah. That would just be my opinion. Of course, you know, now people are like, what do you mean side?
Right. But, you know,
at the time, it would have, you know, put on the end of side one. That would make more sense than putting it in the middle of the side.
I agree with that.
I think, it's a great musical piece, but like you said, well, Transylvania, I like it about the same as Transylvania, but it sounds like a song that didn't get finished. Like some instrumentals, you listen to them and you're like, yeah, that's meant to be an instrumental. This one I hear, I'm like, oh, I could hear a verse over this part. Or, you know, it sounds like Bruce just didn't bother coming in that day and they just said, okay, we'll go with this.
And I don't know about that. I mean, I'm not a huge instrumental fan either. I really like my songs to have lyrics to them and a singer with it, especially when you got a guy like Bruce Dickinson. But Iron Maiden up to this point was kind of known for having those instrumentals mixed in on their albums. And I think this one's just as good as any of them they ever came out with. I love the guitars in it. Adrian Smith just freaking kills on it. I mean, I like it. I think it's great. I don't know what you're talking about.
No, I like it. I love every song on the record. There's, like I said, it's all killer, no filler. But
right. But
there's parts of the song where I'm like, I could hear vocals on that part.
Right.
It's like, it just seems odd that there's no vocals on that part, you know?
Hmm.
Well, I would say, you can have cool guitars and also have a vocal melody, you know? So, what Chris is saying, I completely agree with. There's some instrumentals where you hear them and they really do stand alone. But then there's some where you hear them and you're like, yeah, you could have written lyrics for this. I mean, why not? You know? But
I don't know. I hear that with all instrumentals. I think they should all have the words.
Even Fractured Mirror?
Even Fractured Mirror. Especially Fractured Mirror.
I don't know that I want to hear Ace warbling over that music.
I don't know what he'd be singing about.
The next song I already referenced because I was talking about how Bruce Dickinson has a song on this album he wrote by himself, but it sounds exactly like a Steve Harris song, Flash of the Blade, which, I mean, this is like Sun and Steel Part 2, except I think this song is probably better. I love Sun and Steel, but this song is a little more complex, both musically and with the melody. So this is a great song, but it's pretty straightforward. Iron Maiden, you know, kudos to Bruce Dickinson for writing such a signature sounding Iron Maiden song.
Yeah,
and I even like its positioning on the record. I mean, it fits right where it is. And I'm assuming this is written about fencing. Am I right about that?
Bruce is really in the fence.
Yeah, I knew he was, but I was just like, well, I'm guessing that's what he's talking about in the song. But he's a great songwriter, even on his own. I mean, him and Steve Harris both. That's why they have such an enduring legacy. It's because both of them are incredibly talented, even by themselves. You know, it's
yeah.
You don't have one guy writing everything, or another guy, or you don't have to always have the co-write. So yeah, you're right. I mean, he completely took the Iron Maiden ethos and turned it into that song. It sounds like something the whole band contributed to, really. And yeah, it's a great song.
You know, and speaking of that, the guitar duelry going on in this thing, especially during the solo where the guitar harmonies are just right on the money. God, I love the solo. I love this whole song. One of my favorites on the album.
And this song ended up on the soundtrack it was an Italian-made horror film called Phenomena with Jennifer Connelly and Donald Pleasence. But when it was released in the U.S., it was called Creepers. I guess this song is featured in the movie a few different times. Huh. And but I haven't seen that movie, so...
Is it about fencing?
forget it. It has something to do with a serial killer. That's all I remember.
Jennifer is the new girl in a strange school. She's taunted by her classmates, haunted by a deadly secret.
She's not normal.
And caught up in a murderous wave of terror.
When the murderer hides his victims, he likes to keep in physical contact with them.
But Jennifer's got a few million close friends.
Insects never hurt me. I love all insects.
You're in a position to do extraordinary things.
And she's going to need every one of them. Creepers.
That fly is your magic wand. Ask him to lead you where the dead bodies are hidden, and he'll lead you.
From one of the most acclaimed masters of suspense comes the chilling tale of a young girl trapped in a web of evil. Dario Argento's Creepers. It will make your skin crawl.
Oh, man. Well, go out to your local video store and pick that up.
Mm-hmm.
So the next song, The Duelist, do you guys hear... To me, the verse of this song is way, way too similar to Where Eagles Dare. You guys hear that, but just not as good.
Now that you
mention it, it's crazy
how
similar it is.
I didn't notice it before, but now that you bring it up, I can hear it. Yeah,
I don't know, man. I love this song. I think it's great. I think,
but I love Where Eagles Dare. Also,
I think this is one of the best. Well, yeah, that's true. You know, you say one of the best Iron Maiden songs. I mean, The Duelist is one of my personal favorites, but then again, so is Where Eagles Dare. So I guess that makes sense.
But I mean, yeah, it does sound like it came from the same writing session, even.
It doesn't really even have a bridge, so it's just like the Where Eagles Dare verse, and then it goes right into the chorus, which, my personal opinion, I don't really like the chorus that much.
No,
so,
I think it's awesome. No. I love
this. This would be my least favorite, I guess, on the record.
Really? Holy moly, I can't believe it.
Yeah, it's Where Eagles Dare, and then, yeah, the chorus is kind of a dud for me, so...
Hmm. Huh. I like it a lot. It's not my least favorite on the album. I mean, it's eight great songs. I mean, I don't think there's anything bad on this thing.
No.
Yeah, the next one is that starts off side two is my least favorite on the album.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Has it ever occurred to you that you're just as much a prisoner as I am?
Oh, my dear chap, of course. I knew too much. We're both lifers. I am definitely an optimist. That's why it doesn't matter who number one is. It doesn't matter which side runs the village.
It's run by one side or the other.
Oh, certainly. But both sides are becoming identical. What, in fact, has been created? An international community. A perfect blueprint for world order. When the sides facing each other suddenly realize that they're looking into a mirror, they will see that this is the pattern for the future.
The whole earth as the village. Yes.
That is my hope.
We'll be right back.
Yeah, I'm not a giant fan of Back in the Village.
I love this song. I've always loved this song. Since the first time I heard this album, I think that was the song that jumped out to me. I think it's harder. It's like the heaviest song on the album, isn't it?
And thus is why our show works, because we don't agree on much. But that's yeah. But no, I don't. I mean, like I said, it's not a bad song, but I think it's one of my least favorite on the whole record.
Wow. I love it. I think it's very cool. I think it's hard.
I'll take Lost for Words over this.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. That's something.
I would say neither The Duelist or Back in the Village are bad.
No, they're not.
But they're not great either, you know, so.
It's hard to have arguments about this album because all the songs are good. So it's kind of like, well, this song's great, but it's not as great as that song. So, I mean, that's really what I'm saying.
Well, Back in the Village is kind of a weird song to me. Well, it's another song about the prisoner, right? About the TV show The Prisoner, I think.
I believe so, yeah.
But who did Adrian and Bruce write this one?
Yes.
I think the opening guitar lick, just the guitar lick before the song kicks in, sounds really awesome.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of like groove guitar in this song. It's kind of a weird song. It doesn't really sound like an Iron Maiden song so much. It's that Adrian Smith thing again, right? It's just more of a rock song, but it's got kind of a weird vibe because it's about the prisoner and it's Bruce Dickinson singing. So it's just kind of a strange song. The sum of its parts kind of adds up to something kind of strange to me.
Mm-hmm. I like it.
I like it too.
I think it's borderline thrash. It's like heavy. It's heavy metal.
Well, yeah, it is. It's got a really fast like guitar lick, you know, that the verse rides over that is pretty interesting and pretty different from most other Iron Maiden stuff.
Right. Yeah, it is. It is way different. It almost doesn't sound like a Maiden song, but it's cool, man. I wish they did more songs like that.
So the title track, this is a really weird place to put the title track of an album. It's the second song on side two.
Yeah, the second out of three songs on side two.
Yeah, right. I always loved this song. I clearly remember as a kid listening to this song with the headphones in the dark, and it's a scary song, and it sets a very ominous tone.
Yep.
And I love like the subtle hook on the chorus. When it goes into the chorus, there's a really cool hook there that is very catchy.
To the abyss I fall, I am our own.
some reason I always connected this song to, there's an Edgar Allan Poe story called The Cask of Amontillado, which is a very dark, disturbing story. And this song always puts me in the same mindset. I guess I'm thinking of him in the pyramids or something in the song, but and in the Cask of Amontillado, there's these two guys in the catacombs or like tunnels under the city in the dark, and the one guy, he tricks the other guy into going into a passageway and then walls him in with bricks and like entombs him, like buries him alive underground. And it's, so it's really, and so I always connected this song with that. I probably just was exposed to them around the same time.
A thousand injuries of Fortunato I had borne as best I could. But when he ventured upon insult, I vowed revenge. It was now midnight. My task was drawing to a close. I completed the 8th, the 9th, and the 10th tier. I had finished a portion of the last and the 11th. There remained but a single stone to be fitted and plastered in. I struggled with its weight. I placed it partially in its destined position. But now there came from out the niche a low laugh that erected the hairs upon my head. It was succeeded by a sad voice, which I had difficulty in recognizing as that of the noble Fortunato. The voice said, "A very good joke indeed, an excellent jest. We will have many a rich laugh about it at the palazzo, over our wine." "The Amontillado," I said. "Yes, the Amontillado. But is it not getting late? Will not they be waiting us at the palazzo, the Lady Fortunato and the rest? Let us be gone." "Yes," I said, "let us be gone. For the love of God, Montressor!" "Yes," I said, "for the love of God."
And I remember that Edgar Allan Poe story. I read that when I was younger. But it's this song sounds like the cover of the album. I mean, this song sounds like ancient Egypt.
Yeah.
The way the riff is laid out and the way it's performed. I mean, you feel like you're transported back into an ancient time, and there's a lot of evil, dark shit around you. And it's like you said, it's a scary sounding song. And Maiden, more so than many other bands, were able to, you know, you could throw your headphones on, close your eyes, and you would literally be taken to a completely different place. And this song really does that.
Right. There's certain powerful songs out there that are in hard rock and metal music that can really take you, and basically a song becomes a movie in your mind where every time you listen to it, you can almost see it played out in front of you. You know, it's so descriptive and so powerful, and this song definitely fits into that. One thing I don't like about this song, and I know you guys can both, you know, relate to this, that, you know, we've got podcasts. We work really, really hard all the time to make our podcasts the best they can be. You know, we put a lot of time and a lot of effort into it. We really want them to be really good so people enjoy them. But you know what? Someday we're going to be dead.
True.
Yeah.
It's not a pleasant thought, but yeah.
And our kids aren't going to probably take over our podcast for us and keep them living forever. We're going to die someday.
Okay. Yeah.
Right, so it's not the most uplifting message.
Why can't we live on?
The very dystopian outlook you have there. Jeez.
Well, the other thing, too, I always thought was, you know, maybe when I was in high school, I would have got better grades if my damn history teacher would have been a little more upfront and just came out and said, "Hey, this class, history, no, man, this is an Iron Maiden discussion. I'm here to teach you about all the songs that Iron Maiden's written over the years. You know, come on in, check it out."
Yeah.
I'd have been a lot more interested.
Should start that as a college course.
Shit, yeah.
History told through the music of Iron Maiden.
Through the music of Iron Maiden, yeah, absolutely.
You could say this about the whole record, really, but Bruce Dickinson's performance on this song is awesome.
Yeah.
He was just really, like, takes on the character of the song, and it's very convincing. So
that's why I wish we were able to dig up a little more on the making of the album, because you got to wonder, like, how many takes some of his vocals were, you know, conditions that they recorded in, and, you know, I'd love to hear, somebody should do some sort of behind-the-scenes thing on this record, because there's not much out there to find about it, and it'd be interesting to know how some of these songs evolved, and, you know, did any of this stuff come from, you know, pre-Bruce days, or was it all written around that year, or... you know, because they were a busy band at that time. Now, they had just come off a huge tour, and then they would go on an even bigger tour after this album came out. So it's interesting to know, like, you know, I love Kiss, and I always love Kiss, and they always come up in our conversations, but, you know, you could see why Kiss were able to put out two albums a year, because they were throwing down three-chord songs with, you know, lyrics about banging a girl at the hotel or whatever. You know, you can come up with that quick, but like to come up with some of the complex arrangements and lyrics that they for these albums,
right?
Where the hell do these guys find time for that? You know, I mean, were they laying off the groupies so they could write these songs?
They had to have been.
There wasn't a Polaroid collection in Steve Harris's, you know, bunk or whatever.
Hell no, man. He was busy trying to create hard rock, heavy metal masterpieces.
So yeah, I don't know. It's just this album, also in particular, just. It's so complex, and it's almost prog metal, you know, and that has to take time to craft it that way. And it just blows me away the way they came out with it. And but yeah, I just wish there was more to know about it. But you know, just like all the other songs on the album, this one's amazing. But it's a song that has its own atmosphere to it, and I think this is one that you probably couldn't get burnt out on, no matter how many times you listen to it.
No, never.
No, it's 7 minutes long, but it doesn't feel that
Never.
Way.
Never.
No.
It has, there's like that little mellow part that just all of a sudden kicks in, the just awesome ripping guitar. It's such a cool song.
It really is. Great performance.
Man, I love this album. Everybody, and you talk about Iron Maiden being at the peak of their powers, mm-hmm. you know, and you've seen it throughout history, you know, when a band comes out with a huge album or finally breaks through, then it's a given that their next album, you know, is going to do good, whether it's a great album or not. But this is pretty impressive that Maiden was able to take that popularity, and they could have just, you know, done a whatever album and threw a bunch of junk together and just kept on touring, but they didn't. They really buckled down and tried to come up with something that was even better than Peace of Mind. And, you know, that's pretty amazing to come back like that and not slack off after receiving. You work so hard to get to that peak, you know, and then you hit it. And you could just relax and say, hey, we made it. Here we are. But that's not Maiden. That's not how they do it. Maiden really is music for really smart people disguised as like meathead rock.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so it kind of becomes confusing and conflicting, like a jock, the captain of the football team might pick up an Iron Maiden album because the cover looks cool,
right,
and it's, you know, it's metal or whatever, and then put it on and be like, ooh, yeah, I'm gonna go back to listening to Crew and Poison, you know.
Right. That was me.
Whereas somebody that listened to, say, Rush or Dream Theater, or, yeah, you know, some of those type bands, you know, even Yes, would say, you know, if they listened to the music, said, you know, this is really something here. It's complex. It's smart. It's intelligent. This is something I can really sink my teeth into as a smart music listener. But they never had that opportunity to really sink their teeth into it because they couldn't get past the album covers and the, like I said, the meathead rock kind of mentality that went along with Iron Maiden. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's nothing nerdier or more like proggy than this, the next song, right? As far as Iron Maiden goes.
I looked upon the rotting sea and drew my eyes away. I looked upon the rotting deck, and there the dead men lay. I looked to heaven and tried to pray. Wherever a prayer had gushed, a wicked whisper came and made my heart as dry as dust. I closed my lids and kept them close. And the balls like pulses beat. But the sky and the sea and the sea and the sky lay like a load on my weary eye. And the dead were at my feet. The cold sweat melted from their limbs. No rot, no reek did they. The look with which they looked on me, that never passed away. An orphan's curse would drag to hell a spirit from on high. But oh, more horrible than that is the curse in a dead man's eye. 7 days, 7 nights, I saw that curse. And yet, I could not die.
And yeah, they closed the album out with Rime of the Ancient Mariner. And I'm not a prog rock fan at all. I mean, I like some Rush, but Aaron and I are both in agreement. We like the first Rush album before they became a prog band.
Yeah.
And I like other stuff they've done, but I very much dip my toe into prog, and that's it. I don't like Yes or any of that stuff. But Rime of the Ancient Mariner is like the weird exception, because yes, like this song is one of the greatest songs ever written.
Yes.
And it, you know, possibly my favorite song by the band. You know, I mean, it's strange because it's not one I would typically be into, but it's one of those songs where when I have sunk my teeth into the record, you can't help but listen to all 13 minutes and 45 seconds of the song. You know, it's an amazing song.
It's like if you were playing it and somebody was calling you and going, hey, we got to go, and you were only at like the 12-minute mark, you'd be like, whoa, hang on. And you'd have to listen to the end of it because you just can't stop in the middle of it. I think it's impossible. And, you know, like you said, I don't really, you know, if you want to talk about prog rock, I'm not the guy to talk to. I like Kiss. I like Poison. I like Motley Crue, Guns N' Roses, stuff like that. But if somebody comes to me and says, hey, man, what do you think of prog rock? I'm going to be like, what, you mean like Rime of the Ancient Mariner? Because that's, to me, the greatest example in my world of what prog rock could ever possibly be. Mm-hmm. If prog rock's something that I'm into, it's this song and anything that might be remotely like it. But let's face it, on this planet Earth, there's probably nothing as epic and huge as this song.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's nothing as long.
Well, no, Empire of the Clouds came out last year.
Oh, yeah, right.
That finally bested it for length.
Yeah, can't top it. Please stop it.
The next album's going to have a 30-minute song.
Oh, God. It's going to be one album. It's going to be the song.
Just one song, yeah.
Rime of the Ancient Mariner, Part 2.
It's based on Samuel Taylor Coleridge poem published in 1798. So that's a long time ago.
Yeah, history,
but it's a very cool story. Very metaphorical. And, I mean, definitely turned into a very cool song with, you know, the same kind of vibe. And, you know, like we were talking about how ominous Power Slave is, well, you get the same kind of feeling with this too. The idea that the Mariner, what, the Albatross led the ship out of an ice jam, but then the guy shot it with his crossbow anyways, and then the rest of the crew kind of blames him. They think they're cursed and they blame him for killing the Albatross. And it gets weirder from there.
Yeah.
With the ghost ship, there's a ship with death on it, and all the guys in the ship die except the guy that killed the Albatross, but then they come back to life. And, you know, the whole poem is the guy, the Mariner is at a wedding. He's telling a couple of young guys this story, and that's how the poem is framed, is him telling them this story.
Wow.
But I think the song gets better as it goes.
It does.
So, like, the last 6 minutes is, like, the best part of the song for me. How do you guys feel about the narration? Like, the guy that reads the parts of the poems?
And it's just like we were saying, it's one of those things where in any other circumstance, I'd be like, that's lame.
Yeah, that's stupid.
But in this case, for some reason, it worked.
No,
I don't know.
It's the opposite of stupid. It's genius, and it's awesome, and it's one of the greatest things I've ever heard. But, like, yeah, I agree with Chris. You know, if any other band had done this song, maybe even the exact same way that Maiden does it, it would be dumb. But for whatever reason, Maiden does this huge, crazy, weird, epic thing, and it's right on the money. You can't stop in the middle of it. You got to play the whole thing.
Do you think the song is purposefully extreme? Like Steve Harris was like, all right, we're just gonna do the craziest. We're just gonna take it over the top with this.
I'm thinking it had to have been at least the idea. I mean, it doesn't sound like a song that just fleshed itself out to almost 14 minutes long.
Right. No, this
it sounds
was
like he knew right off the bat that it was going to be a giant undertaking.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's weird because there's lyrics and vocals on it, so it's hard to compare it to classical music. But it's like it sounds like something, you know, Bach or Beethoven would have composed had they been around in the 80s, at least musically, but even lyrically. It's just, it's so damn complex, but it's got movement and emotion, and
right.
and the song takes you on a journey from all sorts of different places, and it's like Power Slave. I mean, talk about a 1-2 punch to end an album, you know. I mean, mm-hmm. it's like the end of the album's a complete mind fuck.
Yeah, it totally is. It's awesome.
And, you know, I don't know, they... greatest album opener and possibly greatest album closer on an album, you know. And,
right.
and it was like, it's only 8 songs. Well, it's still an hour long.
Right.
Thanks
yeah,
to this
true.
Song.
You know, and talking about that, it's almost seems like that would have been something that maybe read that when he was younger and was like, someday I'm going to do this. And then got to the point where they were popular enough to be like, okay, listen, record label, we're going to give you Aces High, and we're going to give you 2 Minutes to Midnight, and they're going to be short, structured rock songs that you can make videos to and put out on MTV, but, you know, you're going to get it, though.
Yeah.
You're going to get something else, too. You know what that something else is? Blam, 13 minutes of craziness,
yeah.
and we're going to pull it off, and people are going to love it.
And thankfully, it works, or otherwise, you know, they would have been playing at an amusement park with Bruce Dickinson pointing to Steve Harris and going, this is Steve Harris on bass. He wrote this.
<He's all> right.
It's a Spinal Tap reference. Jazz Odyssey.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's... I like what Aaron said about Steve Harris being like, someday I'm going to do this. And then I don't know if that's how it went, but that would be like kind of the romantic notion of how it came to this. You know, there's kind of foreshadowing of this, maybe with To Tame a Land as the last song on Peace of Mind, and he wanted to call it Dune, and it's just got a shitload of lyrics because he's trying to fit everything in, like the whole story of Dune he's trying to fit into a 7-minute song, and then on the next album he goes twice as long and goes even crazier, you know, with this really long, really old poem. And so it kind of feels like he was working his way towards this, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, it sounds like it's definitely premeditated. It was not something that just came out of the blue. It sounds like something he probably had planned for a while, or mm-hmm. at least it was a story that he appreciated that he wanted to eventually do something with.
It's a great story, just like, you know, the story of Icarus, and a lot of the stories that they use are really great, very metaphorical stories that, you know,
they seem to pick
make you think.
Yeah,
you know?
They seem to pick the right historical things to reference in their songs. You know, it's always interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a incredible album, and it's going to be getting more spins in my iPod in the future, because I've had a great time just in the last week really digging into it more and listening to it again.
Yeah, it is great. I like Peace of Mind more, but it really is, you know, Peace of Mind, Power Slave is like we were saying, Iron Maiden at their peak.
Well, I know for me, you know, and I appreciate you having us on to do this, but for me, it's really, this discussion today has re-cemented my belief that this is, without a doubt, the quintessential ultimate Iron Maiden album, and I think everybody on Earth should be required to own it and at least listen to it once a week.
Once a week?
Yeah, you know, I'm not saying I'm running for president, but, you know, if I do get elected, we can make that happen.
We're going to make Iron Maiden great again.
We're going to make the world great again by enforcing that law. Once a week, everybody listens to Power Slave. You understand what happiness is. You understand what loss is. You can understand other people's feelings. You appreciate history. You know where you came from.
Start fencing.
And then you know where we're going. If you know where we came from through the lyrics of Iron Maiden, then you know where the world's going. So enjoy.
Well said.
Well, thank you. I probably, every guy in Iron Maiden probably said Power Slave was their favorite, but then when Summer in Time came out, they said Summer in Time was their favorite.
Right.
That's a pretty damn good album, too.
It always goes that way.
I like Summer in Time still, but I think it's got more clunkers than this one does.
Oh, for sure.
This one has, like, there's no fat on this album. It's all trimmed down to the leanest, best stuff. Even if a song is 13 and a half minutes long, I wouldn't change 1 second of Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner.
Nope.
I mean, it's perfect from start to finish.
Heck yeah.
No, it seems like there was a progression and kind of they got to Power Slave. Power Slave was kind of the culmination of where Iron Maiden was going. And then very gradually after Power Slave, they started to become a parody of themselves, which I think is kind of, you know, just like AC/DC or other bands, you could say Iron Maiden were just kind of making the same record because they did, you know, they maintained the same sound. They didn't really change much.
Right.
So by the time they get to Fear of the Dark, you could see why Bruce Dickinson jumped ship because they were just gradually, it wasn't going anywhere by that point. Except down.
Well, I mean, if you put yourself in their shoes, I mean, you can understand why complacency probably is the most comfortable thing to do, is because, you know, we've just sold X amount of albums with this sound and our fans loved it. So, you know, why should we change?
Right,
why should we stretch and do other things? And
you say, look at a band like Kiss that, you know, built their following through this and then throughout, you know, over time became this. And they changed their sound and followed trends and tried to do this, and their fans shit on them for it.
Could you imagine?
We're not going to do that.
Could you imagine Iron Maiden, like, tarting themselves up and trying to do a fucking groupie song or something? I mean, could you imagine what that would have sounded like?
No, I think the closest thing you get to something is Iron Maiden kind of giving in a little bit would be the first two songs off this album. But then again, like you say, you know, we're going to give you a couple of songs you can play maybe on radio, maybe on MTV, but you're getting Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner with it. Oh,
yeah.
Oh, yes, you are. You're going to love it. All 13 minutes.
Yeah, but it's quite a journey the band's been on. I mean, because like you had said earlier in the conversation, BJ, you know, this was the peak, and then it was downhill from this point. You know, it was... You know, they weren't, for some reason, the popularity started to wane, which in the 80s, it was very big on, people were big on, oh, this is big this year, and then next year we'll find someone else to listen to. And, you know, and then things really went off the rails when Bruce left the band, and then, you know, they were adrift for a long time. They kept going, I'll give them credit for that, but they were really adrift until he came back and Brave New World came out, which, oh my God, I love that album too. But, you know, it's... This is an interesting snapshot of history, not just their history, but metal history, because it was really a crossroads time, because it was, you had really heavy stuff, really proggy stuff like this, and then really glammy stuff, all kind of intersecting at a crossroads, and all succeeding that year. So, and then it changed, and then, you know, people started labeling things a lot more, and like, well, glam's big, and glam's going to roll over everything else, until Metallica breaks through in the late 80s. So it's a... It was an interesting snapshot of a really cool time.
You know, Iron Maiden, a little too nerdy, a little too... I mean, you know, Bruce Dickinson's vocal style probably not going to appeal to everyone. And just the length of the songs and the progressive nature, just all of that. But, you know,
and
then you have 2 minutes to Midnight, which there's really no reason that couldn't have coexisted on the charts with a lot of the other songs that were hits around that time.
Right, but there weren't no young chicks running out buying Iron Maiden albums either.
Not really.
No.
Little chickies weren't into
it. They weren't. Eddie scared them all off. And, well, should we mention the stage show? I mean, good God. The stage show, which, you know, pretty much recreates the cover.
Yeah.
With the giant Eddie and, you know, you've got stuff that's like stories high on the stage.
Yeah.
It's, I'm jealous of any of you that are listening that got to see that live.
Most definitely.
That had to have been one of the greatest stage shows of all time.
Yeah, they did a massive 13 consecutive months, I think, 28 countries tour.
The World Slavery Tour.
Yep.
Yeah, and then they released a double live album out of that, which was a huge deal as well. A video and everything, so.
Oh, and I should say there is one negative that came from that live album. Gerard Way from My Chemical Romance says that that album and that video is the reason that he's doing music today. I read that in an interview. That's the one bit of research I did pull.
Wow.
So, yeah, so if it wasn't for Iron Maiden, we wouldn't have My Chemical Romance. So think about that.
Way to go, Maiden. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, but all of that reinforces the idea we're talking about, that this is the peak of Iron Maiden, because you get Power Slave, Live After Death, World Slavery Tour, Live After Death, all of that together. That's Iron Maiden at their peak.
That's a hell of a year.
Most definitely.
Yeah.
And talk about how different the songs are on the album, where bands like My Chemical Romance is getting influenced by it, but so are like hard rock bands as well.
Yeah.
This has been awesome today.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you guys so much for coming on the show and talking Power Slave with me. It's a very focused topic to try to get you to talk about, but I love the idea of... It's really fun to really dissect a band's discography like this. And, you know, what better band to do it with than Iron Maiden, really.
And now, to play us out.
What does that mean, to play us out? I don't know what that means, to play us out. What does that mean? To end the show?
Yeah.
I'm going to leave you with a B-side from the 2 Minutes to Midnight single. It's called Mission from Airy. Airy was a nickname for Steve Harris, and this is actually a tape recording of an argument. It was recorded by Bruce Dickinson surreptitiously. The argument was between Steve Harris and Nico McBrain. Took place after a gig in Allentown, Pennsylvania, during the Peace of Mind, the World Peace Tour. During the concert, Steve Harris had a problem with his gear, either his bass, his amp, something. And so he asked the nearest roadie to try to communicate to Nico McBrain to extend his drum solo so that the issue with Harris's gear could be dealt with. And so the crew member tried to communicate this to Nico, apparently during the drum solo, and it didn't work out so well. Nico McBrain felt distracted, felt it had negatively impacted his drum solo. So afterwards, he started yelling at the roadie, who was just trying to communicate a message from Steve Harris. Nico McBrain was unaware of this, apparently. So Steve Harris stepped in, was trying to defend the roadie to Nico McBrain. Bruce Dickinson had a tape recorder with him and decided to record the conversation. And then they ended up putting it on the 2 Minutes to Midnight single. And interestingly enough, when Nico McBrain found out that Bruce was recording this, apparently he tried to smash the cassette, and Bruce had to frantically stop him and save the cassette because on the other side he had ideas for the next album, Power Slave. So this is that argument between Steve Harris and Nico McBrain, recorded by Bruce Dickinson. Till next time.
All he's trying to do is relay a message from me to you, right? And he went the wrong way about it, okay?
Yeah, he did go the wrong way about it. I tell you what, I mean, it ain't going to happen again.
I don't think we get steamed. I mean, if the trust was
going to... Why it got steamed up, Bruce, is because it fucked me right off and I knew there was a problem and I still didn't know what it was, even after he... I fucked up. And I stopped and it was like, oh, for fuck's sake. Come on, kids, and I'm looking around at them. Now's the time to tell me what's the problem.
Can't you understand? If I hadn't tried to get a fucking message through to you, right? It'd have been a lot worse. If I hadn't got my gear done, as it happens, just in the nick of time I got it done.
I still didn't get the message.
I know you didn't. But what I'm saying, whatever happens, if I didn't try to get a fucking message to you, you know what I mean?
Sure, Steve, but the fact is that the guy was not handling it the right way.
You don't think of things like that, Nick. No,
but that's the...
I'm on the other end.
It's me that fucked up. I'm the one out there all on my own doing a drum solo.
I'm the one thinking that I've got fucking like a minute to go before me to get this fucking gear.
Yeah, if somebody gives a message to me, you know? I mean, it doesn't matter who it is. I mean, the message...
Bruce, it's different for you. You're not standing there all on your fucking own having somebody try to get your attention and talk to you. I'm playing a drum solo, and the guy's standing a yard to 2 yards behind my drum rider.
What?
What? By the time I got that far, I'd fucking totally fucked. Because I'm not paying attention to my gig, I'm paying attention to what he's trying to do.
Yeah, would have noticed.
I noticed.
I completely understand that.
Fuck me right up.
But he was only doing what I told him to do. And that was getting a message to you. Now that they're fucking eat at the moment and just everything like that, he don't think to fucking tell Bill. He wants to get the message to you, not the fucking Bill, so he don't think of that. He just tries to get the message to you, right? So he don't fucking deserve to get a bollocking for that. I mean, alright, he got one, I know. Not saying that, but I just don't, you know. Bill's a nice guy. He's not like he's an arsehole.
No, I know.
Or an idiot.
He was out of order because he didn't
listen. He wasn't out of order.
He was wrong.
He was because he fucked me up by trying to tell me. He'd have come up to the riser. If he'd have come up to the riser there, I could have fucking heard him.
But Nick,
cunt was standing behind, sitting down.
Yeah, but he was wrong. He made a mistake, but he wasn't out of order.
It wasn't deliberate.
He made a mistake.
I didn't know that at the time, right? I still didn't know that Steve had a problem with his bass. Luckily enough, by the time I finished the Poxy solo, he had his bass working.
All it takes is to get
the creep was because I bollocked him up and I had to tell you. You're going, don't bollock him, go and apologise. Like, fuck am I not going to go and apologise to you.
Well, all
you
gotta
it's
go
not for me to apologise. I bollocked him because he fucked me up. Rightly, he fucked me up.
No.
He was wrong.
All you got to... No, he wasn't wrong.
He was.
It wasn't
he
wrong.
Did not handle it. He's not in fucking community.
I don't fucking argue about this. It's fucking stupid. I think you're really out of order. I think you're honestly...
No, bollocks. I am not out of order.
Oh, your attitude is out of order.
No, it ain't.
It is.
No, it ain't. The guy fucked me up.
I know he did.
Well, then that's out of order. Look, I'm not saying he fucking meant to, Harry.
Well,
the fact is that he was a dumb cough because he don't know how to fucking communicate with me.
He's not a dumb cough.
He's not fucking stupid. Well, he fucking certainly did a good job out there this afternoon, didn't he?
He made a mistake. Because
why did he make a mistake?
Because I...
You sent him. How could he make a mistake?
That's right.
How did he make a mistake?
Well, he made a mistake by not sending Bill first, right?
Well, he made a mistake, right?
Yeah.
Well,
there's a difference between making
that's what
a
mistake.
There's a difference between making a human
right.
error.
So he made a mistake, right?
Yeah.
And I'm briefed up because he fucking made me make a mistake. Now, now I can understand what he was talking about after the fact. It remains to be seen.
Oh,
he was on a mission from you.
I'm not going to argue about it.
Right? Fuck my old boots. It just... I can't handle that situation when people think some kind of heavy grief and it's important to me to get a message like that. Fucking hell. How can I get some... When I also fuck as well, I wouldn't have minded if I'd have got what it was happening straight. Like, on the end, oh, right, Harry's got his base butt. Right, I'll carry on and do something else. Yeah. Then that's fine. If I didn't fuck up. But it made me fuck. It totally threw me right out, and he didn't know how to talk to me about it. And I've told him, don't do that again.
He's not there to relay a message to people.
And he never turned around.
Look. It could have been anybody. He was the first one on air.
Harry, he never even turned around afterwards and said, listen, I'm sorry, but you didn't understand what I was saying, right?
Well, why should he?
Well, then because he got stood up for himself, because he knows he was got the bollocking wrong, because he was sent on a mission from you.
He's probably fucking upset.
He's probably a bit upset.
Because you gave him a fucking bollocking.
Rightly. I told him, don't ever do that again.
That's crazy.
Right,
what happens if the lighting truss is going to fall down on your head? Does he go...
Well, then somebody drags me out the fucking way, or else I'm dead, right?
Yeah, but
I mean,
your
attitude is so. No, it ain't. No, it ain't.
Yes, it is.
No, it ain't. If I'd have known, now I'm the fucking cunt all of a sudden.
No, you're not the cunt.
Because I've told him he was out of order, and I didn't know he was on a mission from you to tell me that your base was fucked.
I know
all you've got to do, Nick,
I
was just go to the guy and say,
sorry about Shanae, it was a misunderstanding, but in future, tell Bill. That's all you've got to say.
No.
And that way. He's a fucking proud geezer. He does his job.
I bollocked him. No, it ain't pride. It's not fucking pride.
It is pride.
No, bollocks.
What's the matter with you?
The guy was wrong to have been fucking there to do what he done.
No, he isn't wrong. What's he supposed to do? Turn around
with a different attitude? Because this is fucking... I've told him straight out not to do it again. I'm not going to go up and apologise for saying that to him. He was out of fucking order.
He's not out of order. What happens if I fucking go and tell somebody to do something, he goes, no, fuck off. I'm not going to do that.
Listen, Bruce.
Then he's out of order.
Bruce,
Steve goes and tells him to go and
do
something.
I'm not concerned with other people that can't fucking talk to me on stage, who don't know how to fucking communicate with me.
But he's not out of order.
He does not know how to communicate with me.
Some cunt's recording this.
I'll be back.